back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here with Lance. How's it going tonight?
It's going pretty well. How are you, Tim?
Doing great. Tonight we have a blogger on who has just dipped her toe into the blogging realm. Her name is Erin Larkin. She goes by Gorilla Ontologist on her blog, the107degree.com. And the link is in the show notes. And she's got an interesting perspective on this case. What do you think, Lance?
Erin had been in contact with us for a little while before she started her own blog, and it was something that, as you'll hear in the interview, something that she decided to do kind of in spite of the case. Like, she had to do it because of her connection with UMass, her age, and just the way she breaks down the case just seemed to make a little bit more sense to get it out there. And what she has to say is really interesting. And she brings a certain amount of logic to the case that we really like.
Yes, very interesting interview, and we will roll it in just a moment. But first, we want to say thank you very much to Blue Apron for sponsoring this episode. So check out blueapron.com/missing for your first 3 meals free with free shipping. And also want to introduce a new sponsor, Casper Mattress. Pretty great company. We will be talking a little bit more in depth about these two later, but check out casper.com/missing. Okay, thank you for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at Maura Murray Doc, and we hope you enjoyed the interview. Deborah Larkin, welcome to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. First question I have for you is, why did you start this blog?
At first, when I started to get into the case, I wasted so much time on things like the $4,000 and went down so many rabbit holes and realized that there was so much misinformation out there or things that had been focused on that didn't really or potentially didn't matter for the case at all. So I thought it might be valuable to clear some of that up and try to focus on the things that mattered rather than the personalities and the people that the characters, if you want to call them that. I think it's weird to call them that, but the more personal stuff that I just thought was not relevant.
Yeah, we just recently had a guest on who is working really hard to clear up all that white noise, as he calls it. So it's good to have that out there.
Yeah, I like the way he put that. I think that's exactly right.
So why you? What insight do you have to add to this case?
I'm trying to think of a good way to put this. I think that there was a gender component that might have been a little bit missing, and I feel like I was close enough to the case to that people could understand why I was interested, but not so close that I necessarily have a dog in the fight. And I think that some of the other people that you've spoken with have been dismissed, and some of the ones that you haven't spoken with, like James Conrad, which is automatically dismissed his whatever he said because he is perceived to have some sort of ulterior motive, and I think even John Smith and several of the others, like they're always dismissed because of some ulterior motive. So I thought I might be a person that could I don't have any motive. I don't have any or anything that could be dismissed as such.
Now, tell us why you have a partial connection to the case.
Okay, so I was at UMass in 2004, and I ran track in cross country 2003, 2004 that year. I knew Kate. She was my big sister on the team.
Big sister would be like a mentor?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's Kate Markopoulos we're talking about.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I also worked the same job as Maura at UMass Security. And, you know, obviously from the same part of the world, Irish Catholic family.
Okay. Now, I know people are listening and they're probably talking to their devices and saying, how well did she know Maura? Did you know Maura? And if you did, how well did you know her?
No. I mean, I knew of her and I knew that she existed. I'd seen her around and I'd heard her talked about, but I would not say that I knew her or I was friends with her. I was a freshman, and she was a junior. I know Kay was a senior.
Didn't you run track with her?
She was injured that fall season, so she didn't go to practice or anything. And then she was supposed to come back that first week of February, and she didn't.
What was the nature of the injury?
I heard it was her knee, but I'm not positive about that. I don't know exactly what the injury was.
How was the talk about her? You said that people were saying, oh, she's coming back soon, or, you know, she'll be joining the team at some point. Were they optimistic about that because she was a special runner?
No, I think it was more, the talk that I heard was between Kate and Julie, our coach. And it was just, they were trying to figure out, or Julie more so was trying to figure out when Maura planned to come back, if she planned to come back.
So Julie is the coach, not to be confused with Julie Mora's sister.
Correct.
Okay.
Did you ever have a conversation with Maura?
No, not that I would remember, at least.
What happened that week?
I remember, I sort of remember, like, flashes, at least as it pertains to, like, the case. And I remember Kate's face as she was talking to our coach and explaining what she knew, which was basically nothing. I think it was a Wednesday that the coach was just like asking her where, what had happened and what happened the weekend before and what the situation was. And she was just, it seemed like she had a hard time explaining because she really had no idea. She seemed really surprised at what was happening and sort of overwhelmed, but didn't seem that she was lying or holding anything back at all to me.
Did she have any conversations directly with you about it?
No, I was there and overheard. I was sort of like, I had been injured that week. And so I was just in the coach's office and in the varsity gym while they were discussing everything. And so I was present, but I had nothing to contribute. I didn't add anything to the conversation. I was just there.
How do you recall the moment so well?
Well, a couple of reasons. I had just come back from that part of the world. I'd been skiing in Bretton Woods and Warva Valley the weekend before with my family, and they were still there. And I decided to come back for practice and for classes. And I drove back the opposite route that she had taken on that Sunday night. And the next morning was really the first official day of spring track that Monday. And it was a morning practice and it was absolutely freezing and really awful, not very fun at all. And I got injured from, it was actually an injury that I had gotten the day before skiing, but it just got a lot worse that day, and it ended up that I was done competitively running in college after that.
Something that's out there that there's a lot of speculating about is the state of Maura's room and whether or not it was vacation time and how things were packed. And just to get rid of the white noise about that, can you tell us when was vacation and when did people come back and if the state of her room is accurate to your knowledge or if that struck you as odd?
I mean, it didn't strike me as odd, but she also, like, there was no indication to me that she had packed everything up, because the way that UMass works is during the winter breaks, the whole university, like, all the dorms except for one, I think, like, an international dorm, is completely locked up for cleaning. So you turn your keys in, the RA, like, examines your room, makes sure you don't have anything, like, candles burning or something crazy like that during break, and you turn your key in, you basically take everything home with you that you are would be concerned about anyone going through, because you know that people are going to be walking in there throughout the break. And then you move back into the dorms, essentially, at the start of the semester. And so I know we've heard that she had a single dorm, but there, as far as I know, there weren't really single dorms. There were more than enough dorms than there were people. So some people ended up with a single dorm, and it was based on seniority. So as a junior, she would have had pretty high seniority, except that she had come in midway. So she would have been like just on the verge of, had somebody needed like emergency housing at the beginning of the semester or something like that, she could have ended up with a roommate. So it makes sense to me that she wouldn't necessarily have unpacked everything yet until the end of ad drop, at least. And I mean, I know that there's been some talk that like she had the boxes packed on her bed, but there were two beds in those dorms. Every dorm had two beds. So that I sort of dismissed that.
Because she would have slept in one bed and the other bed would have had the boxes on it.
Right.
And so you think she may not have ever unpacked?
Yeah. I think it's very unlikely, very likely that she just never got around to unpacking. I mean, for all we know, maybe she didn't necessarily want to live on campus. Maybe she was looking for off-campus housing. You never know until the end of ad drop period when everything is sort of finalized.
So as we're talking about the dorms, this brings up another area of, or this brings up another topic that generates a lot of speculation about this party that happened the night that she had the accident with her father's car. There's rumors that it was this party, and no one, you know, people can't believe that members of the party aren't accounted for or remembered. Some people say it was a really small party because you couldn't have a party that large in a dorm so small, and you know, how can you forget people's faces at a party? You were there during that time. Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about that culture and, you know, our parties? And I know that colleges have parties and it's common, but what was it like there?
I mean, UMass, especially that section of the university sort of broken up into five different sections. And Southwest, where Kate and Mara had lived, was definitely known to be the more social party sort of atmosphere. But at the same time, the dorms were, like, really small. They were, like, I want to say 10 by 10. I'm not sure if that's accurate. But they were very tiny. And, like, basically you could fit two beds, two desks, two dressers, and a half a closet or something.
Yeah.
And that was it. So, but, yeah, people would gather together every night of the week. So I sort of think that the term party might be a little bit, could be perhaps misleading or make it seem more like bigger than it may have been.
Were you at the party?
No, I was in New Hampshire.
Did you know Sarah Alfieri?
No.
Did you ever hear Kate talk about her?
No, I don't think so. Or I don't recall if she ever did.
Tell us a little bit about the job that you had. It being the same as Maura's is pretty interesting. Is there anything in the story that we all know so far that you think is different than what the common knowledge is?
Well, I know that there was some question about what time it ended, the shifts would end. And I know that, I think UMass had some sort of flyer or something in writing saying that during the week the shifts went till midnight, and then on the weekends they went till 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. But I know for a fact, I remember that Thursday was included in what UMass considers a weekend. So, and Sunday was not. So Sunday they only went till midnight, and Thursday I want to say it was 2 a.m., which means you'd start packing up your stuff to leave at 1:30 a.m. So she was, I do believe, and I understand why people question it, and I wouldn't necessarily take my word for it either. I wish there was another way that maybe I can track down a pay receipt or something, something that shows this and clearly, but she definitely would have been working until 2 a.m. that night or 1:30 at the very least, on February 6th. So the other thing is, it would have been really hard to leave during the shift, because you have to have somebody watch the desk at all times. Like, you had breaks, but they weren't, it's not like you went out to get some like fast food or anything. You could go to the vending machine. You didn't leave the building. Like, you just didn't. So it seems to me very unlikely that she would have left during her shift. Not impossible, but certainly unlikely.
Who would the people be that would see someone leave during a shift like that?
I mean, she could have see them leaving the building, or...
Yeah, because you said, when you said you couldn't leave, just made me think that there was, you know, somebody that she would have to pass by, like a manager or a supervisor. Just seems like kind of physically tough to leave without being seen.
She could have, like, snuck out the back or something like that. But there, the supervisors, like Karen, they'd be making the rounds. They call them rounds. So they'd come around to every dorm, somewhere between like 45 and 70 minutes or so, like once. And they'd stop in, they'd sign in and make sure everything was okay. See if you needed a break or anything like that, because someone had to be watching the desk at all times. So there were at least like three or four supervisors walking around at all times.
And Mara leaving or not leaving is relevant because of Patrit Vassy was hit that night. And of course, we've talked about it at length on this podcast. And if you've looked into the case online, you've undoubtedly seen the connection that people theorize that Mara might have hit Patrit Vassy. And then that was the reason she took off to New Hampshire, sort of in an emotional spiral. So you're saying that you think that's extremely unlikely.
I do, yeah. And not impossible, but it seems very, very unlikely to me.
Before we continue, let's just take a word from our sponsor, Blue Apron. Lance, I know you love this product. I love it as well. What's been your experiences lately?
Dude, I love them.
Yeah.
Since we started getting these Blue Apron shipments, first of all, I look forward to Wednesdays now. I look forward to tracking it on, getting the alert that it's been delivered. And the app is awesome. So you get the alert that it's been delivered. You come back. It's in the little box. You open it up. It's like all packaged for you. And I can sustain a week on that. Two servings. You get one. You have an extra. You put away. Next night, you make another dish. Tonight we're going to be doing the salmon dish, which I'm super excited for. I just trust them to send me whatever they want to send me. But the pork so far has been my favorite.
Better than the crispy catfish?
It was better than the crispy catfish.
To me, nothing can beat that right now. Yeah. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/missing. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/missing. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
And we'd also love to mention Casper Mattress. Casper makes one mattress fit to help everyone dream their way to a better life. It has just the right sink, just the right bounce, and it keeps you cool all night. And with Affirm, you can finance your Casper for over 6 months with 0% APR interest.
Just select Pay with Affirm at checkout to finance your mattress through flexible monthly payments with transparent payment terms. Checkout is quick and easy. You'll never experience any hidden fees or surprises. 0% APR means 0%. So head over to casper.com/missing to try the mattress for 100 nights. If you don't like it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. But I know you'll love it. And you'll love how it's packaged. This mattress comes to you in a compact box. It comes in one of those airtight wraps. You cut it open, and then it's like a game. It's like, I mean, how fun was it to watch that thing? You cut it open, you just watch it pop out, and then it's hilarious. It just grows to its natural thickness.
The mattress has been incredibly comfortable. It replaced our old one, and I just could sleep for about 3 or 4 more hours per night on this Casper mattress. Well, check out casper.com/missing to try the mattress for 100 nights. Thank you very much, and here is the rest of the interview with Aaron Larkin.
So your notes and your looking into the dispatch and the call logs for the night of the accident are really detailed. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how you approached that?
I thought that what John had said at some point on one of the podcasts about the 7 p.m. timeline was really interesting, because I do remember that all the media reports had focused on, or had originally said that she had crashed like just after 7. And then the two witnesses that said that they heard that scanner call, that a female had went off the road near Swiftwater Road, but it wasn't in the log anywhere. So I tried to sort of go through the other town logs for that night and see if there was anything that sort of resembled what that call could have been. And I found one that seemed to stand out for a couple of reasons, and that was call number 4754. The first thing was that the time between when the call was logged and when police were toned out to the scene was 64 minutes, which didn't really seem to make any sense to me, because it was a level 2 out of 3 prioritization, which would suggest that it was more, should have gotten more attention than seems to have. But then the other thing was the narrative says that there's no PI, but they need the fire department and the wrecker. But then it goes on to say that the subject was requesting an ambulance.
PI being person injured, right?
Person injured, right. But then after all that, no fire or EMS was ever dispatched. So to me, I sort of had to wonder if this might have been the 7 p.m. call. Because we know that there were 3 missing calls between, I think, 6:30 and 8:30, or somewhere in that range, right around the time of the crash. There's 3 missing calls, each 2, which is Cecil Smith from out of Haverhill, is at the scene. So Groton is where this call took place, is about an hour from Haverhill. And during the entire time that this call had taken place, he was supposedly at Morris scene. So at least in the logs, he was in 2 places at once and an hour apart from each other.
Okay, so just so I understand, there was this call for the 7 p.m. accident that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In a town that's about an hour away from Morris accident.
Correct.
The 7 p.m. call has Cecil Smith being in Groton at that scene.
Yes, and sorry, let me say this. It in the log, it states that it was at 7:49. It doesn't say that it's at 7. I think that this could potentially be the 7 o'clock call, the narrative from the 7 o'clock call that's missing from the logs.
I see. And what does it say at 7:49?
So at 7:49 was the 4754 call in Groton, which was also a motor vehicle incident that was called in by radio.
And this one has H2 there?
Yes. It takes place from 7:49 to 8 or 9:04. And with that whole time, he was supposedly in Haverhill at Morris scene, which is now
at 7:30.
Right. Because he was there from 7:46 to, I think, 9:26.
Okay.
Right? So that sandwiched in between Moore's time frame, which was 7:46 to 9:26, is this call in Groton, which is 7:49 to 9:04. So there, it seems to me impossible for him to have been in 2 places at once.
This might be a dumb question. Why would a Haverhill police officer be in Groton anyway?
That I cannot answer. I have no idea.
But you're sure that H2 is not H2 from Groton?
I don't think so. I looked into like how the police and New Hampshire in particular codes all of their coding system essentially for the radio, and I think each town sort of has their own shorthand. So I know Franconia is K, Haverhill is H. I don't know much about the other ones, but I know I sort of highly doubt that they would have this overlap in that system, because the whole point is to like distinguish them and not confuse the system or sure. not confuse the situation.
Sure. So if there's a Groton police officer there, it would probably be G, right?
Right. Exactly. In fact, I think it is G, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Okay. But what we do have is H2 at the scene of Mora's accident.
Correct.
And H2 at the scene of a Groton accident.
Right.
At the same time.
Right. So yeah, there's this gap, like literally a space in the log that John was given that he had posted, and the gap in time was from, I think, like 4:57 or so until Mora's accident. I could be wrong about that, but essentially the hour and a half or 2 hours before her accident in the Haverhill log was missing, and there was a chunk of white space. And so if that had been the 7 p.m. call that the witnesses heard, it would have made sense for it to be there. It seems to match up with sort of exactly what they were saying. And Cecil Smith was there. So that would, you expect he would have been at that call as well. Well, the one other thing I want to say about this one is the next call that Cecil Smith was dispatched to was on Limekiln Road, and he cleared Morrisine at 9:26 and was dispatched to this the intersection of Limekiln Road and Route 25, which was a 20-minute drive. And in the logs, at least, he arrived at 9:35. So it took him 9 minutes to get to a scene that should have taken 20 minutes. So there's something weird about the time there, again.
So at the very least, we're talking about incredibly sloppy dispatch bookkeeping.
Yeah, and I don't know how normal that is, but I don't think it doesn't seem to sort of like subvert the entire reason that you have these logs. I mean, the purpose seems to be for precision.
Right.
And so.
Or, I mean, don't do it if you're not going to, you know, don't have code and don't do it like with the 24-hour timestamp that they have on it. I mean, if you're not going to be accurate. But it does sound like they have a fantastic like time warp up there where you can make a journey in half the time that it should take you. 9 minutes to go about a 20-minute drive. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems sort of impossible to me. So there's something definitely weird happening with the times, I think. But yeah, the other thing was there were a couple of calls that stood out, and the first one, it was actually one that I had noticed where an officer didn't respond, and that's in the Franconia log. Later on in the evening, it was said something to the effect of, and I can try to find it, I'll pull it up, but the officer was off in the area of the motel and didn't respond. And so that sort of, it made me curious about what that could have been, because we know that Mara was looking for a hotel. So then I looked for other instances where this officer was in the log and found two more. The first was something, it didn't really make sense to me at all. All it said was S1 or SL16 was inquiring about the phone number. And I sort of dismissed that because I couldn't figure out what it meant. And then it started to bother me. So I eventually figured out that SL in the New Hampshire frequency coding system means state liquor license. And 16 would be the 16th entity, what license number 16, essentially. Because New Hampshire has that weird alcohol regulatory system that I don't really understand. But it's run, I think, out of the state police. So then I looked up what SL16 was, and it was Button's Liquors, which was one of the places that perhaps Maura was seen at before she got into the accident.
Right.
I know that I've heard at least that the family took that seriously, that sighting seriously. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that it's been confirmed, but or if there was any video or anything, but I know that there was a lot of talk about it. But I did think it was interesting regardless, why this officer who was not Haverhill or Woodsville officer would have been inquiring about that number at that particular time. So perhaps it suggested that he was in the area at least at 7:08 p.m. And looking for that number. Then I was looking more into the log around the time when trying to figure out what was holding up Butch Atwood's call from going through, and the call just before the major call just before Morris was that suicide attempt around, I think it was at 7:17 rather, and they dispatched a bunch of officers and EMS, fire, everything to the scene because it was a level 1 emergency. And this particular officer had been dispatched at 7:21, and then en route, I'm sorry, dispatched at 7:20, en route at 7:21, and then before he arrived, for some reason he cleared the scene. He never arrived. Something came up apparently, and he cleared out at 7:28.
Cleared the suicide call.
Right. Okay. He never arrived at it though. So between the time that he was dispatched and began the journey to the to that incident, something happened. That's all that we can sort of logically conclude that would cause him to clear out of that scene and not arrive, never arrive. But there's no indication that he went anywhere else. So the next time he's in the logs isn't until several hours later.
I wonder if that's a common practice for police officers to clear a scene if they get another call that's a higher priority, and if fire and ambulance has it under control. I wonder if that's a common practice. I mean, we don't have an answer for it right now, but maybe someone out there can shoot us a message and just say, you know, whether or not it's common for somebody, the responding officer, to be on their way and fire and EMT tells them if he has a higher priority call, you can clear it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely possible. But I've looked sort of where he could have been going, and there's nothing saying that he was dispatched anywhere else or he didn't radio in about another incident or
okay, that's
he doesn't show up anywhere. So I mean, maybe he just took his, you know, his break for the evening.
So
got dinner. But exactly. It seemed like an odd time to do that.
During a suicide call.
Yeah, well I mean, yeah, to start off en route to one and then just, you know, decide they got this. I guess I don't have to get there.
So at the very least, we're just talking about a lazy police officer who might have got a call from fire and EMT saying, we have the situation under control, and he says, great, I'll clear it. And then he just goes and does something else, like sets a speed trap or something, because there's nothing in there to indicate that he was called to a more important or a higher priority.
Yeah. From everything I know about this particular officer, he doesn't seem like the lazy type.
Right. If he's got a call, he's going to see it. I mean, look at that. It's a small town. We're not talking New York City here. It's not 1,000 things going on all at once. If he's got a call, chances are he's going to go to that current call. Clear it when he gets there. So, Aaron, you recently sent us a piece of information that more research that you've done in regards to the 001 and Witness A's account.
So assuming that I sort of have her route correct, like she saw 001 around the cottage hospital and then continued on and then saw the same car again around Goose Lane, then that sort of that time frame would match up sort of perfectly if someone had been near this around Swiftwater at that presumed 7 p.m. call accident, gotten dispatched to up in Littleton, and had been on their way. But it's about an 8 or 9 minute drive from the Cottage Hospital to Goose Lane. So had it been the same officer that was dispatched at 7:20 and cleared the scene at 7:28, it would have made sense that he was on his way east with his blue lights on. Possibly, and I'm not sure if this is possible because I don't really understand police radio frequencies that well. But if he had heard the call that came in from Faith Westman at 7:27, known that he was in the area, and decided that maybe it was more urgent for him to go to that, it would have made sense for him to sort of double back around and have passed witness A again, taking a right onto Route 112, and then arrived at Morris scene.
Still aligned with witness A's account that she saw the same vehicle pass her twice.
Yes. Yeah. If she had left around 7:15, 7:20 from where she worked, past the Cottage Hospital at around 7:21, and seen that officer who with his blue lights on heading east, and then gotten to the Goose Lane at 7:28, or around, it's about a 9 minute drive. And if it was the same officer that I'm referring to, he cleared out of that one scene that he had been going to and decided instead that there was something more urgent right around the corner, then it would make perfect sense that he would have perhaps passed her again around 7:28, 7:29, 7:30. The timing works out perfectly.
So you're saying the officer who was responding to the suicide call, who cleared that, could be 001.
Could be 001. And this particular officer, at least I know in 2007 he had been Franconi at 001. And then recently I found things suggesting that in 2003 he would also have been driving the SUV. It's the next town over from Haverhill, just east, like a couple miles northeast of where the accident is.
So you're saying you believe there's a chance that this officer McKay was the driver that witness A saw and not Jeff Williams?
I think it's possible, yes.
So that's not so convoluted as originally thought. Based on the police dispatch logs, the timing works out where Officer McKay could be on his way to the suicide, gets the call for something that is pretty much right around the corner from him at the time, clears the suicide because other officers and fire and EMT had it under control, so he clears the scene on his part and proceeds on to Mora's accident in 001, passing witness A twice.
Mm-hmm.
Timing works out based on those logs.
Just about perfectly. And I mean, I think the part about him inquiring about Butson's, whether or not it had anything to do with Mora, it was right in that area, right around at 7:08. I mean, that's when he called in to get that number. Wasn't his town. It isn't his town. So to me, it seems like there was something going on that required his attention in that particular area. So all those things together sort of make me wonder if it was his SUV and not Haverhill 001.
Wow. Okay.
Also, I remember Fred Murray saying that a couple of witnesses told him that they had heard officers arguing about jurisdiction in the area or at the scene that night.
In a hotel.
Yeah. And it sort of makes sense that the next town over is Franconia. So I can't really think of any other who else would be arguing about jurisdiction other than the state police. State police, Franconia police, and Haverhill. Those are the only three options, really. And perhaps the federal, some federal entity, but that seems unlikely. So those three are really the possibilities that we have.
Aaron, you have a really interesting take on the red liquid that was found at the scene of the accident. Can you give us a little insight into that, into your thoughts on that?
Sure. So it sort of stemmed from the hunch that I actually don't think that Maura was drinking and driving. And I know that's not very popular of a theory, but at the same time, it just seems to me like the only evidence that we have of that is the crash that she had gotten into 2 days earlier that potentially, we know that she was drinking some quantity of alcohol that day, but she wasn't given a ticket or cited for drunk driving. So she couldn't have been too bad. And that's really the only evidence we have that she had a problem with alcohol. And at the same time, like there's a huge difference between driving a few miles on a familiar road home after a party on a Saturday night and literally drinking and driving hundreds of miles away on unfamiliar roads. It made no sense. It was sort of a huge extreme difference that that people have tried to say that one, the first implied the second, and I didn't buy it at all. And just looking at the other items in her car, there was one thing called a Lumiseal, which the only reason that you have that is if your coolant's leaking. And it repairs problems with the heater core and the radiator. And so if she had had a problem with the heater core, then the first thing that would happen would your coolant would start to leak. But also, one of the other symptoms is that coolant actually leaks through the floorboards into the dashboard and into the cabin of a car, because the heater core is like just sort of behind the dashboard. And if the airbags had gone off, that might explain the red liquid on the ceiling, because all GM cars at the end of 1996, every single one used the type of coolant that's red. It's ethylene glycol. So it more than likely her car had required the red type of coolant. We have pretty good evidence. I mean, there's no other reason that she would have a Lumiseal unless there was a coolant leak at some point. And so it seems possible that the red liquid, both underneath the vehicle and on the ceiling, was coolant, especially given the fact that it's hard for me to buy that she was trying to hide the Coke bottle under the car when she left an entire box of Franzi wine in plain sight behind the driver's seat. I mean, it states really, really clearly in the log that it was in plain sight. But it doesn't state that it was open, which you'd think that if it had been, it would have been the only unambiguous, like, instance of that we can point to say this was absolutely a crime, because right. It is illegal to have
open container.
Like, it makes no sense. Why wouldn't you put it in the trunk where it's actually legal to carry an open container? Why not carry it with her or throw it over the snowbank? Anything, but leave it in plain sight when you are going to great lengths to hide this Coke bottle. It just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And the other thing is the head gasket that I think Fred's mentioned it, the car was running on three cylinders. And I think what he meant was the head gasket was blown. There's actually one of the ways that you can sort of trap the excess exhaust when that happens is with a Coke bottle. You put a Coke bottle under inside the hood of the car as like a an extra exhaust tank, sort of an overflow tank. And you put coolant in it.
How do you know that?
My dad was big into GMs, and my brothers are mechanics, so I know some stuff, like enough to know sort of what to look into and what would be normal and what wouldn't be. It would have been sort of weird for her to, I don't even know how she would know how to create that hookup, but it's possible that someone she knew made a makeshift overflow exhaust tank in her under the hood. More than likely, it was coolant that she made from antifreeze and water and kept with her in the car, along with a Lumiseal and a radiator funnel, because coolant had leaked at some point in history. Like, it would have been sort of reckless to not bring coolant along on that trip if she knew that there were issues.
And that plays into the red liquid found beside the car, because if sniffed by an officer, it would smell like alcohol. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, ethylene glycol is, I mean, it's comprised of, it's like one, you know, one atom or whatever off of being ethyl alcohol, which is drinking alcohol. But who knows, like, what it had been mixed with. I mean, if she had had the problems that Fred said she had, then there could have been oil, like, who knows what was in it? There could have been a Lumiseal in it. Like, the way that the can of a Lumiseal, the way that it works is you mix it with antifreeze or coolant, and put it in right into the radiator. So, which brings me to the rag. I think the rag very likely could have been that the engine was hot and she didn't want to burn herself. So when she unscrewed the radiator cap, she used a rag. That's it. And it probably, just not to get, you know, coolant all over the place and not to burn herself.
And then why did she stick it up the tailpipe?
I mean, I can think of two reasons. The first, which is silly, but something that I would probably do, is I wouldn't want to get coolant all over my stuff in the trunk if I had clothes back there or anything. And if no one was going to be driving the car, I might just, and I'm not wanting to throw it away, I just might put it in the tailpipe. The other reason, she could have also been trying to hide smoke, like Fred said, of course, but I do think that's possible. But the other reason, if she was really in a rush and she had already locked the car and the rag was out, then maybe it was just, you know, instead of throwing it on the ground, she just put it in the tailpipe. Because she didn't want to get out her keys and unlock the car and all that stuff. So maybe that's it. I don't think that it was anything more than that, because we know that it came from her trunk. So there's only a certain number of things that could have happened for it to wind up in the tailpipe. I just don't think it was anything nefarious.
Interesting insight from Aaron. What'd you think, Lance?
What's really refreshing about this interview is the point of view that we get from Aaron. I didn't consider that the red liquid might be coolant or radiator fluid or something other than alcohol. It's funny when you have the perception out there that there's a box of wine in the car and there's the Diet Coke bottle and it has an alcoholic smell to it. So you put it together and no one, you know, it's just one of those things that no one can prove, but it just gets out there and just starts becoming a fact. So it's very refreshing to get the alternative point of view and just a fresh eyes, a logical pair of fresh eyes.
And we hope you enjoyed it. And we will be back with more Missing More Murray soon.